All right. Good evening and welcome to today's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. We are online at thecommonwealthclub.org, on Facebook, Twitter, and check out our YouTube channel. I'm Soren Solari, CEO and founder of Simigence, building the future of simulated intelligence for personalized health and nutrition. As an innovator, engineer, and neuroscientist, I've spent a lot of time both writing algorithms and working out how the brain works, so I'm really excited to be your moderator tonight to have this conversation. Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths share a fascination for both computer science and what makes people tick. Their new book, Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions, allows them to explore the parallels between the everyday human problems and those faced by computers. They offer up some practical solutions and different way to think about rational decision-making, which I think we need a lot more of probably in the world. Brian Christian wrote the best-selling book, The Most Human Human, and regular reports on a variety of topics for popular magazines and scientific journals. Brian holds degrees in philosophy, computer science, and poetry from Brown University and the University of Washington. Tom Griffiths is a professor of psychology and cognitive science at University of Berkeley, where he directs both the Institute of Cognitive Science and Brain Sciences and the Computational Cognitive Science Lab. He's also a prolific writer and has published many scientific papers. He studied psychology at the University of Western Australia and left his home down under to earn graduate degrees from Stanford University. Welcome Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths to the Commonwealth Club. Thank you so much. So to begin this conversation, Brian and Tom will give a little bit of an introduction to algorithms and what they mean. And Brian will begin first. Thanks.
Great. Thank you so much for having us. It's a pleasure to be here. The book opens with an example that I think will be perhaps painfully familiar to those of us who live here in San Francisco, which is the search for housing. Now, we typically imagine in a consumer scenario that what you do, if you want the best thing available, is you go out and you consider all your options and you look at each thing and you think about the one you like the most and then you pick that. In the context of San Francisco housing, this sort of fact-finding structure is simply a luxury that you don't have. You go to an open house and it's mobbed with other people who want the place, and you know, half the time the check ends up or the keys end up in with the person who can physically hand over the check first. And so such a savage marketplace doesn't leave room for this kind of fact-finding and deliberation. Instead, what you have is a structure where every place you go to presents you with an irrevocable choice. You can either take the place right in front of you and never know what else might have been out there, or you can walk away to gather more information, but you're forfeiting that opportunity to do so. And so this is a scenario that is kind of cruel and almost bordering on paradoxical, which is how do you try to make an informed decision when the very act of gathering information jeopardizes the outcome? Fortunately, there's an answer, and the answer is 37%. If you want the very best chance of getting the very best apartment, you should spend the first 37% of your search. So if you've given yourself a month to find a place, that would be the first 11 days. Don't bring your checkbook. You are purely calibrating. After that first 37%, be prepared to immediately commit to the first place you see that's better than what you saw in that first 37%. This is not merely an intuitively satisfying compromise between looking and leaping. This is the provably optimal result. And we know this because it belongs to a class of problems that are known as optimal stopping problems. And many people have argued that the structure of optimal stopping problems, where you have a series of opportunities and at each point you either commit or you walk away, describes not only our search for housing, but our search for love. And there are some, Tom will discuss in a minute, some people have gone so far as to explicitly apply the 37% rule to their dating life, where they define some interval over which they want to find someone, just crunch the numbers and figure out what's 37% of that interval, and that's the moment to commit. Of course, it all depends on the assumptions that you're willing to make about love.
So the premise of our book is that just as in this problem, there are many problems which arise in human lives where we can get a benefit from thinking about those problems in terms of algorithms or ideas from computer science and mathematics. So there's a set of problems that we think about as being naturally human problems, things like how do you find an apartment or how do you find a partner? How do you figure out what to keep in your closet and what to throw away? How do you figure out how to cram as many things into your schedule as possible? And the interesting thing is that, in fact, they're not human problems. They're problems which are shared by people and by computers. So human lives are lived in finite time and finite space, and computers face exactly those same kinds of constraints. And as a consequence, we can turn to the wisdom of computer scientists who have been grappling with those problems for decades and find solutions that are perhaps equally relevant to the context of human lives. And in the process, maybe learn something more about how it is that our human minds work when they're engaging with those problems. So this example of optimal stopping problems is something which we engage with in the book. There's a whole set of problems that we consider. Today we're just going to give you a couple of our favorite problems, and then maybe when we're discussing, we'll get into some of the other problems in more detail. So optimal stopping is something which is, I think, an unrecognized but constant part of the structure of human lives. And the particular problem that Brian was talking about, the problem that leads to this 37% rule, is one of the most famous optimal stopping problems. It's called the secretary problem. And it was first introduced to the public by the mathematician and writer Martin Gardner, who had a column in the Scientific American in 1960 where he first sort of brought this problem to light. So the structure of the secretary problem is you're trying to, say, hire somebody. You have a pool of applicants, and as each applicant is interviewed, you can judge how good they are relative to all of the other applicants, but if you, and you can make a decision about whether you're going to offer them a job or not. But if you decide not to offer them the position, then they're gone. You never see them again. They disappear. And so you've kind of lost the chance to hire them. And so the challenge then is, how do you know when to stop? How do you know to switch from, you know, just interviewing people to being ready to make offers? And as Brian was saying, this has analogies to other parts of our lives. In fact, the origins of this problem, as we discovered when we were researching the book, are in the domain of romance. So our best guess as to where this problem came from was actually the work of a mathematician who was very concerned about the love life of his daughter. So this was Merrill Flood, who was a mathematician at the University of Michigan, and his daughter had recently graduated from high school and was engaged in a relationship with a much older man. And so he and his wife felt, you know, sort of worried about this and were trying to figure out how they could communicate to their daughter that this wasn't a good idea. And it turned out she was taking minutes at a mathematics conference where Flood was presenting. And so he stood up in front of the room and he posed this problem. A woman has a series of suitors. She has to make a decision about, you know, which of their proposals to accept. So when does she, you know, when is she ready to accept a proposal? And Flood didn't know the solution to this problem, but he guessed that the answer was more than one. And he hoped that in the back of the room, his daughter made the same realization. So that story had a happy conclusion. In the end, his daughter broke up and went on. Other mathematicians who've been trying to apply the 37% rule to their own love lives have not necessarily met with the same kind of success. And part of this is that the assumptions behind the secretary problem are very strong and may not be a perfect match for the scenarios that we actually face in our love lives. So one mathematician who realized this is Michael Trick, who's an operations research professor at the Carnegie Mellon University. So Trick was 26. He was in a relationship with somebody. He applied the 37% rule, assuming he was searching from between 18 to 40. 37% of that period is 26.1. He realized he should propose to the woman that he's with, and then she turned him down. So rejection of an offer is not something which is factored into the basic secretary problem. And it turns out to change the math. If you can be rejected, then you should switch to making offers sooner. So you should make offers early and often. If there's a 50% chance that you get rejected, then you should switch from looking to leaping after just 25% of your pool. So it turns out that things worked out well for Trick. So, you know, having been rejected once, he realized that he should still continue to be making offers, and he subsequently made an offer to a woman who became his wife and was very happy. Another mathematician who sort of grappled with love was Johannes Kepler, the famous astronomer. And after the death of his first wife, Kepler was trying to find somebody who would become his second wife. And he approached this in a very systematic fashion and sort of interviewed all of the potential candidates for the position. And in the end, he went through, he interviewed the first, he wasn't quite satisfied, saw the second, wasn't quite satisfied. He was quite interested in the fifth, but he decided to move on, and he went through the whole sequence through 11 women in the end. But getting to the end of that sequence, he realized that, in fact, the fifth was the right one. So in a letter to one of his colleagues, he decried his restlessness and doubtfulness that had led him to miss out on this opportunity. But in the end, when he went back and he proposed to the woman who was fifth, she ended up accepting him, and turned out she hadn't had any offers since, and so everything worked out okay. And it's not a surprise that it turned out okay, because in fact, restfulness restlessness and doubtfulness are in fact ingredients of the optimal solution in this situation. So in this situation, the thing that was different was that there was a chance, having passed over a candidate, that you could still go back to them. And if that happens, that changes the math again. So now you should switch from looking to leaping after a longer period, and then at the end go back and make an offer to the very best person you've seen if you didn't have the chance to make an offer to them already. And so for example, if there's a 50% chance that somebody who you've passed over will actually take you, later on, then you should switch at 61% of the way through the pool. So that's after 5 out of 11. It turns out Kepler was following a pretty good strategy, and so it's not a surprise that things worked out okay. So these kind of optimal stopping problems show up all over the place. In the book, we talk about optimal stopping problems that come up when you're trying to sell a house, when you're trying to decide, how to quit when you're ahead. For example, we can ruin every single heist movie by taking that scene where they're trying to coax the old thief out of retirement to come back and do just one more job. It turns out mathematicians have analyzed that problem. There's a solution. The thief just needs to crunch the numbers, and then he'll have the answer. Again, a nice San Francisco problem, which is parking. So you can work out exactly where you should switch from driving past empty parking spots to being ready to take the next spot that you see. If, say, 10% of the spots are free, then you should make that switch 7 parking spots from your destination in order to minimize the distance that you end up walking. If, say, 1% of them are free, then it's 70 parking spots away. And if 0.1% of them are free, maybe a more realistic San Francisco number, then it's 700 parking spots away, and you probably should just leave the car at home. So one of the things that seems like an unrealistic assumption in optimal stopping is the idea that you have to sort of make a decision about each thing in turn, that everything is coming in a series. But in fact, when we think about it, that's in many ways a more realistic characterization of the sorts of decision problems that we face in everyday life than the way that we might intuitively think about decisions. It's not something where we've got all of the options and then need to figure out which of those options we want to take. Most of the time when we're making a decision, we have to consider each option in turn. We have to spend time discovering each thing. We have to spend time thinking about it. We have to kind of work through those things. And human minds operate in a fundamentally serial fashion where we can only consider one thing at a time and have to consider one thing after another. And so the basic structure of our minds and our lives is something that means that whenever we're making a decision, one of the most fundamental things we have to do is solve that problem of deciding when to stop.
Many of the decisions that we make in life have this character, of making a single decision that's a binding commitment. And there's a second class of problems that is also ones that we encounter pretty much every day, in which we're making kind of an iterated, repeated decision. So, for example, the question of where to go out to eat. Specifically, decisions like this take the form of a tension between doing our favorite things and trying new things. So in the context of restaurants, do we go to our favorite restaurant, or do we try the new place that just opened up down the street? On the way there, do we listen to a classic album that we know and love, or do we listen to the radio and maybe discover something else? And who do we go with? Do we go with our spouse or our family member or a close friend, or do we reach out to you know, a new colleague who joined the office or a new acquaintance that we'd like to get to know better. I think intuitively we all understand that a life well lived consists of some kind of balance between leveraging the experience that we have to do the things that we like best, but maintaining an openness to trying new things. What our intuition does not tell us is what that balance should be. Fortunately, computer scientists have been working on this problem for the last 50 years, and they even have a name for it, the explore-exploit trade-off. In normal English, exploitation has a very negative connotation. But to a computer scientist, these terms are value neutral, and exploration means spending your energy and time gathering data, and exploitation means spending your energy and time leveraging the data that you've already gotten. And so it comes up in the context of this canonical problem within computer science that's called the multi-armed bandit problem. And the name is a little bit funky, but it refers to the idea of a slot machine as a one-armed bandit. So in the multi-armed bandit problem, you walk into a casino that's full of slot machines. Some of them pay off more frequently than others. Of course, you don't know ahead of time which are which. So the question is, let's say you're going to be there for the afternoon. You have time for, let's say, 100 pulls. What strategy do you do that enables you to walk away the richest? Intuitively, it's going to involve some balance of trying different machines out to get a feel for which ones seem the best, but also just spending a certain amount of your time just cranking away on the machines that do seem the most promising. This problem, the multi-arm bandit problem, was for much of the 20th century considered unsolvable. And there's this great history where the Allied mathematicians during World War II in Great Britain joked about dropping the multi-armed bandit problem over Germany as the ultimate instrument of intellectual sabotage. But surprisingly to many, even those within the field, there was a series of advances and breakthroughs over the course of the second half of the 20th century. And one of the critical ideas that's present in some of those advances is that your strategy all depends on how much time you plan to be in the casino. So if you think about it from the perspective of, you know, you've just moved to San Francisco and you want to go out to eat. Well, the very first restaurant that you go to is literally guaranteed to be the best restaurant you've ever been to in San Francisco. The next night you go out to a different place, it's got a 50-50 chance of being the best restaurant that you've ever been to in San Francisco. But that rate is going to go down as a function of your experience, enabling you to set a higher bar. What's more, not only the odds of making a great discovery like this, but also the value goes down over time as you run out of opportunities to go back and exploit that discovery. So if it's your last night in town before you're about to move away and you happen to discover the most charming restaurant that you've ever found in San Francisco, there's something kind of tragic about that, right? Like you think to yourself, well, I wish I'd known about this years ago. And so naturally, the parameters of our decision-making should change as a function of where we perceive ourselves to be on the relevant interval of time. You know, naturally, college freshmen should behave differently than college seniors. We should behave differently when it's our first night in town than when it's our last night in town. And part of what I think is so fascinating about the story of this problem is that it has led not only to things like ad optimization algorithms on the internet, A-B testing algorithms, which decide, you know, do show someone the best performing ad or try a new ad. But it's also led to advances in psychology and cognitive science in terms of new ways of thinking about both the beginning and the end of our life. So at the beginning of our life, you know, we think of infants as stereotypically random, and they have a short attention span. There's this like strong bias towards, you know, just relentlessly trying new things, no matter how great the toys are that you buy them. They're always more interested in something else. And there's a new group of cognitive scientists, including UC Berkeley's own Allison Gopnik, that are appealing to the idea of the explore-exploit trade-off and saying, Well, if you think about it, these things that look kind of deficient about infants actually are just exploration. You know, if it is your first few moments in the casino and you've got 80 years to be there, you really should go around just pulling levers at random. You really should just put every object in your living room in your mouth at least once, because it could be delicious, and if it is, you have 80 years to enjoy it. And likewise, you know, when we think about people in their later years in life, we have stereotypes about the old, that they're, you know, set in their ways, resistant to change. There's a bunch of studies to the effect that older adults maintain fewer social connections. And so it can be tempting to read this as like, oh, well, maybe that's lonely or something. And likewise, a group of psychologists, including Stanford's Laura Karstensen, are kind of leveraging the intuitions of the explore-exploit trade-off to say, no, these people are in the exploit phase of their life. And in fact, her research has shown that older adults are purposefully and deliberately pruning their social world to the people that matter most and are happier for it. One of the sort of overarching qualities of a good solution to the multi-armed bandit from a computer science perspective is that it offers what's called logarithmic regret. And specifically, this means that when you are following a logarithmic regret strategy, there's bad news and good news. The bad news is that even following the best strategy, you will continue to make mistakes throughout your whole life. The good news is that you will make mistakes at an ever slower rate, and the mistakes that you make will be ever smaller. Algorithms that have been honed in computer science context that have this guarantee of minimal regret have now become a subject of interest to the FDA, who's looking at borrowing some of these algorithms for use in revolutionizing clinical trials, where you likewise have this choice between doing the familiar thing and trying something new. And so thinking in computational terms enables us not only to make, you know, to see differently our everyday decisions about where to go out to eat, but it gives us a way of thinking about the whole arc of human life and, in some cases, some extremely specific guidance when we need it the most.
So optimal stopping and the explore-exploit trade-off are two of the kinds of problems that we talk about in the first part of the book. We really focus on problems where we see this close parallel between human lives and the things that computers have to do, and where we can get insights about optimal strategies that come from computer science. So other examples of problems that we discuss are sorting, so how you should, you know, alphabetize your bookshelf and whether you should think about doing so. Caching, which is about how to organize information so that you can most efficiently find the information that you're most likely to need in the future, and incidentally, how to organize your closet. Scheduling, which is where we take insights that come from computer scientists trying to think about how to get computers to use their time as efficiently as possible to figure out how to use your time as efficiently as possible. And making predictions about the future, where we use ideas that come from statistics that allow you to make good predictions in circumstances where you might think that you don't have enough information to be able to do anything at all. In the second half of the book, we turn more to the kinds of principles that underlie good algorithm design. And we talk about advances in computer science that are really about dealing with the incredibly difficult kinds of problems that are characteristic of the sorts of things that human beings have to deal with. So in computer science, these are called intractable problems. They're things for which, if you try and solve them exactly, you're going to spend an immense amount of time trying to come up with a perfect solution. And as a consequence, computer scientists have explored different strategies for dealing with these problems, like using randomness, where you give up on getting exactly the right answer every time, or approximations, where you are going to get something which is close to the right answer and can do so much more efficiently. And then we also talk about how it is that ideas from computer science can inform the way we think about interacting with others, things that come from the theory of networking and from game theory. So one of the insights that comes out of exploring these different kinds of algorithms and the strategies that computer scientists have used to engage with the sorts of problems that human beings face is, I think, a much more nuanced notion of what rational behavior is. When we think about rational decision making, we typically think about somebody who is going to consider all of their options, they're going to carefully think through the pros and cons of each of those options, and then they're going to reach exactly the right answer every time. And that's kind of the intuition that we have about how computers solve problems too. But in fact, when we look at how it is that computers engage with these intrinsically difficult problems, what we find is that they do something very different. That sometimes they don't consider all of the options. There can just be too many to make it worth the time to do that. Sometimes they don't spend a lot of time on each of those things, but you know, I maybe use a very quick calculation or take chance as a way of solving the problem. And they don't always reach exactly the right answer. They reach something which is a pretty good answer, trading off the amount of effort which is put into solving the problem with the amount of time that goes into it. In many ways, computers are a better analog for us of a rational system, because than the sort of intuition that we get from something like economics, which thinks about an ideal agent as one that has infinite computing resources and infinite amounts of time. Computers like us are finite systems with finite amounts of time and have to deal with difficult problems. And as a consequence, we get a different kind of standard of rationality. It's one that says that, you know, taking a chance is okay, that, you know, sometimes you want to leave a mess, that you're better off, you know, getting something which is pretty good than getting a perfect solution. And this kind of insight is something which I think is different from the intuition that we might have about what it might mean to lead a life that's inspired by computer science. It's one that's much more forgiving, and it's one that looks much more human.
Thank you so much for that intro. I think this is just an exciting field. So I'm going to take a few steps back, and then we'll hopefully delve into maybe some other details. I have some nice questions already from the audience as well. So maybe for the people who are curious, what is an algorithm in human terms?
Yeah, the word algorithm actually has a really interesting etymology. It's in reference to the Persian mathematician Al-Khwarizmi. My roommate who speaks Arabic taught me this pronunciation. It really just means, in the simplest possible terms, you know, a series of steps that you follow to make a decision or get a result. And so, of course, we can think about, you know, computing in these terms, but there are a number of things in human life that are algorithmic in nature, including, you know, baking bread from a recipe, or, you know, making fine stone tools by a precise sequence of strikes. And so in many ways, you know, you can think that algorithms were a part of human technology, not only since before computers, but since about the Stone Age.
Yeah, I think people, when they hear the word algorithm or hear that you work with algorithms, it's a lot like saying you're a rocket scientist. You know, it's kind of cool and sexy, but it's like, don't tell me any details, really, of what you do. You know, you guys in your book actually do dive into quite a bit of the details and trying to explain, really, at a quite detailed level, technical level, of how these work. How did you strike the balance, or how do you strike the balance between bringing out that technical detail but also making it accessible?
Well, I think one of the principles that motivates the book is that we only talk about algorithms that are what we think of as being, you know, human viable algorithms, right? So things that human beings can actually use in the context of their own lives. And that criterion is one that means that, you know, the kinds of algorithms that we focus on are ones that are very simple, intuitive, and very concrete in terms of their applications. So we talked about one algorithm. The 37% rule is an algorithm. It says, you know, spend 37% of your time looking, then after that, make an offer to the, you know, first person you see who's better than any of the people you've seen so far. That's a simple algorithm that you can follow. And in many of the chapters, the kinds of algorithms we discuss are equivalently simple and equivalently concrete. And so I think having that criterion of looking for things that are useful for people and that can be sort of executed by people was something that made it in many ways easier for us to solve the problem of communicating some of these ideas that come from computer science.
Interesting, yeah. There's a few questions. Let's frame this in a high level, in a way. As you discussed a little bit about the optimal problem, you called it the secretary problem. We call it the multi-armed bandit problem. I guess it brings me back to thinking about some of the other big answers in other fields like physics, right? That actually started with thought experiments. Let's say Einstein in physics thought about, what if I were sitting on the beam of light, traveling at the speed of light, what would happen? And this, you know, resulted in E equals MC squared and its theories of relativity. How important are these thought experiments to algorithms, and what role do they play?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that the book gets into, which is an interesting story in its own right, is just the story of where these optimal strategies came from historically. What were the eureka moments and the moments of insight? And so, as I mentioned, in the case of the multi-armed bandit problem, for most of the 20th century, it was not only considered unsolved, but unsolvable. There was a famous dinner, I think it was at Oxford, where one of the mathematicians said that he had an idea for a solution to the multi-armed bandit problem, and his colleague replied, "Sir, the multi-armed bandit problem is not of a form that may be solved." And part of what's so interesting about the thought experiment, the thinking that has led to some of these breakthroughs. So in the 1970s, the Unilever Corporation hired this young mathematician named John Gittins to help them figure out basically how much of their money should they spend on drug research and development versus how much should they spend on, marketing profitable drugs. So and Gittins thinks to himself, oh, this is a pure case of the explore-exploit trade-off. How much energy you spend getting information versus leveraging the things that you know work. And, well, it's too bad that the, multi-armed bandit problem is unsolvable, but the Unilever Corporation needs me to do something, so let me come up with what would at least be a pretty good approximation. This is his thought process. And he says, okay, what would be the best approximation? And he comes up with this strategy that's called the Dynamic Allocation Index. We now know it as the Gittins Index. And it turns out, to the field's astonishment, including his own, that is the solution to the multi-armed bandit problem. And so that's a lovely moral, which mm-hmm. is, if you're up against a problem that's impossible, just figure out what would be a pretty good approximation, and you might surprise yourself.
That's interesting. There's a few questions coming up around this sort of topic, and that is, I guess there's a popular idiom that says, and I'm not sure I can say this, so I'll spell it out, but to assume is to make an ASS out of you and me, right? So in some ways, we're encouraged to minimize the assumptions we're making, let's say, about each other or people. But in the algorithm world, like you're saying, assumptions, not only do we make them when we're creating algorithms, but they're sort of foundational to the solution that we come up with. Can you expand a bit on sort of what the, and some of the questions revolve around, how do you factor in the non-quantifiable elements of some of these decisions, right? Yes, I know you're telling me I have 37% and I have to park, 700 parking spaces in a way, but, there's other real world factors. Or if you're talking about relationships, how do you factor in emotions and sensitivity? How do assumptions play into algorithms? And can you just expand on that a bit?
So I think there were four great questions there.
There's quite a few.
So we'll work through those different ones.
Yeah.
So the first of those is about, I think one question we could take out of that is that there are strong assumptions that are going into these algorithms, like the 37% rule. Like I said, in the secretary problem, we assume this, we assume that, we assume this. So one nice thing is that in many cases, such as the secretary problem, those assumptions have kind of been explored pretty exhaustively by mathematicians. The secretary problem is an example of such a nice, fun problem that's interesting to work on, that involves interesting math, that all sorts of generations of mathematicians have kind of played around with it. And as a consequence, pretty much any objectionable assumption in that problem that you can imagine, they've kind of figured out an alternative solution to. And we have this... We actually spent like the first 6 months of research on the book just like reading about the secretary problem and all of these different kinds of variants and so on. And we have an extensive endnote which discusses them if you're curious about it. And I can get into that more if you want to throw some at me. But what's interesting there is that I think one of the characteristics of the problems that we human beings face, and one of the ways that, at the moment human beings are better than computers, is when we run into something which, you know, doesn't perfectly match those assumptions, where we don't know exactly what the optimal solution is, human beings are pretty good at nonetheless interpolating and coming up with some kind of good strategy for solving those problems. So more broadly than just the very specific kinds of solutions that we can say, if you're in this situation, do this, if you're in this situation, do this, if you're in this situation, do this, one of the things that we hope our readers get out of the book is a sense of what optimal solutions look like and how those solutions change when the assumptions are modified. Because from that, I think you can just better inform your human intuitions and do a better job of solving those human problems. I don't know, Brian, if you want to take one of the...
Yeah, I mean, you know, the other domain that this makes me think about is, you know, Bayes' rule. So, you know, there's there's a whole class of problems that mathematicians pejoratively refer to as ill-posed problems. And what that means is there's not a single solution, but there are multiple viable solutions. And the, you know, in general, the class of problems that involve predicting the future based on some, you know, data that we've observed fits into this category, where there's any number of projections that you can make from this very limited amount of data. You know, as we say in the book, we think of computers as the masters of big data, you know, finding a pattern in several billion data points. But often, real-world decision-making involves, you know, extrapolating from a comically small amount of information, you know, like a single data point, and then you have to make a prediction. You know, if you're working on a construction site and it says, you know, there's been 7 days since the last serious accident, you, if you're considering whether to take that job or not, need to project into the future and say, well, how long from now do I think the next accident will be? And so in general, you know, inductive reasoning, of which Bayes' rule is such a big part, requires you to have some assumption going in order to make sense of that small amount of data. And so, you know, it's really not a question of wanting to not make assumptions as wanting to simply make the correct assumptions or the most informed assumptions.
An important point, yeah.
Yeah, I wanted to pick up just one more thread of that question, which was, what about emotion, right? I think, you know, I was saying earlier that, you know, it's a little bit surprising to see the kinds of recommendations that come out of thinking about how computers solve problems. I think it challenges some of our intuitions. And one of those ways that I think our intuitions might be challenged is that, in fact, there are rational arguments for a role for emotion in various kinds of decision making. There are rational arguments for impulsivity, first of all, right? For, you know, for acting upon a smaller amount of information rather than, you know, spending more time thinking or more time gathering information. And part of that argument is that basically gathering more information or spending more time thinking about the information that you have is something that can end up meaning that you're focusing too much on the details and too little on the bigger picture, and as a consequence, you end up making a worse decision. And there's a mathematical argument that justifies that, which is about what statisticians call overfitting. But a lot of other kinds of emotions are things which show up more in the context of interpersonal interactions. And in the book, we discuss these in the context of game theory. So emotions like anger or love might seem like things that are very far away from what we might think of rational behavior being like. But you can give arguments, and economists and, you know, evolutionary biologists and anthropologists have given arguments that, in fact, those emotions are useful precisely because they help us solve some of the challenging problems that are posed by interpersonal decision making. So, for example, having the capacity to fall in love is something which, in a sense, restricts your options, right? You end up overvaluing one person, you know, far more than you should if you have irrationally decided to fall in love with them. But that very restriction of your options is something which makes you that much more attractive as a partner, right? You want to fall in love with somebody who can fall in love with you, right? Because they're going to be committed to the relationship in a way where they're going to irrationally ignore those potential attractions that might economically or along some other dimension be a better deal than the one that you're offering. and in the same way, anger is something which, you know, restricts our options. It makes us do crazy things. But to a game theorist, having that capacity to do crazy things is something which then helps us solve the problem of how to deal with conflict, where, you know, if you know that the other person could go crazy if you do the wrong thing or if you cheat them or something like that, then that increases the costs for engaging in that kind of behavior. And as a consequence, you know, means that you might end up, all of you together, reaching a better solution.
Thank you. Let me take a pause to say that this is the Commonwealth Club of California program, and we're talking to Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths, authors of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. I am Soren Solari, your moderator. You can listen to Commonwealth Club programs on the radio or podcast, watch our program videos on our YouTube channel, and catch up with us on our website and on Facebook and Twitter. I'm going to take a pause and mix it up just a little bit, maybe with like a quick lightning round. So this will just be fast off-the-cuff answers from both of you. So
three words or less.
Yeah. They don't have to be quite that short. Some will be relevant, some will be off-topic. What is the last book you read? Not your book.
I have been reading Flash Boys by Michael Lewis.
Tom?
Let me see. So I'm currently reading a science fiction novel. But
all right.
It's on my Kindle, so I can't remember what it's called.
That makes sense. So what is your favorite algorithm?
Oh, man. That's like having a favorite child. You can't remember that. Do you have one? I have to think of one.
Well, the thing that I use all the time in my work, in my research, is Bayes' rule,
okay,
which is a principle of mathematics that comes from an 18th century minister who basically figured out how we can quantify uncertainty about the world and then update our beliefs as we get more information. So that's something that turns out to be fundamental to explaining how it is that people learn and, you know, make inferences from limited data, something that's characteristic of what we do every day.
I've got one. In the context of the explore-exploit problem, the multi-armed bandit problem, we talk about the class of algorithms that have this guarantee of minimal regret. And one of the ones that I think is the most like poignant is called upper confidence bound. And the basic idea here is that in any situation, you have some distribution over how good you think things could go. And the upper confidence bound algorithm says, always do the thing with the best case scenario. And in the context of, you know, going out to restaurants, for, you know, to take a silly example, you know, if a restaurant's terrible, you only have to sit through one bad meal and you just never go back. But if it's amazing, you can go back as many times as you want. And so the structure of the problem itself demands, if you will, a kind of optimism. And to me, that's very beautiful.
So if you had to be honest, do you really use the answers to these algorithms in your everyday life? Someone asked, do you ever use 37% to make any decision?
I think that the intuition, you know, in the multi-armed bandit problem, the intuition that you should be more exploitative as you run out of time is definitely something that I think about in my own life. So earlier this year, I got engaged, and my fiance and I are moving in together, and we were going to move in to her place in Oakland. And so we thought, okay, you know, this is our last chance to go to all of our favorite places in the city. But even though we have all these favorite places in Oakland, we should nonetheless like force ourselves to try new stuff because we've got like this whole new chapter of our lives opening up in the East Bay. And then we changed our minds, and in fact, she's moving into my place in San Francisco. So it was like, wait a minute, 180, we need to now exclusively do our favorite things in Oakland while there's still time, and then force ourselves to try new things in San Francisco.
I've now had a chance to check my Kindle. So the book I'm reading is called Nine Fox Gambit by Yoon-Ha Lee, which is basically about weaponizing mathematics. It's really cool.
Wow. exciting.
I mean, I think more generally than the specific algorithms, again, the sort of the principles behind those algorithms are things that both of us use all the time. And that was a lot of the motivation for the book, was that you know, me in my research life and Brian in his exploration of this relationship between, you know, humans and computers, I think we both ran across all of these incredibly interesting ideas, and having this way of looking at the world where we're looking for the computer science structure of human problems, and then knowing that some of these problems are solvable, that's what, you know, mm-hmm. we were doing in the context of our own lives, and made us feel like, yeah, this is something that other people need to know about too. So one principle that I use a lot is thinking about this phenomenon of overfitting, right? Of kind of, you know, basically this is a good way, if you're a perfectionist, to get yourself out of it, which is knowing that if you're spending more time optimizing something and the function that you're optimizing it with respect to, right? So if you're like trying to, you know, write a report or something like that, and the measure that you have of the quality of it is your own subjective perception of it, right? That quantity is different from the quantity that you actually care about optimizing, which is somebody else's perception of it, right? So the gap between those two things means that the more time that you put into optimizing it, the further you could potentially be getting away from the thing that you're actually supposed to be optimizing, right? The gap between what you can measure and what matters is going to determine how hard you should be working in terms of trying to optimize that thing that you can measure. And so this is a principle that shows up all over the place. We talk about how it shows up in, you know, like airline security and all of these other kinds of things. But it's one that's particularly relevant in terms of just being able to recognize that there's a point at which you should, you know, stop, you know, just dealing with the details of something and be, say, you know, it's done and I need to move on.
I think that's a subtle point. I'm going to come back to that right after these softer questions. I think. So if you could be any animal, which one would you be?
I have always been, I'm from the East Coast, and I've always been fond of migratory birds because I feel like they get to always be where the good weather is, and they get to see so much of the world. So that's my pick.
It's a good one.
I'd be a human, I think.
Human? No, it doesn't count. You can't be a human. You have to be some other animal.
Touche.
I don't know. So my impression of cats, like my way of understanding the mental state of cats, is to believe that they are essentially like, you know, the mental state that you would be in if you were just listening to NPR all the time. Right? So they can just sit there and they can be like, you know, be completely complacent. So that seems like a pretty good mental state to be in. So
interesting. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay, so yes or no, will machines take over the world?
Yes.
Okay.
Maybe yes, but we will be them.
Interesting, the transhuman. All right, so let's come back to some of the algorithms. You mentioned overfitting, so I think this is actually quite relevant because, you know, as you said, this is kind of finding a perfect solution to a problem reflecting some sort of specified goal, but potentially at the expense of other goals, right? So if I define success as money, then I might sacrifice all of my time to get money, right? So because I didn't incorporate time as a goal. And we see this, I think the real relevance of this is, you know, in our capitalistic society or as companies, how we measure reward, let's say, drives the decisions that people make and whatnot. And potentially in healthcare, how does, is the goal or metric that people are trying to fit the solution to cost, or is it, let's say, patient outcome? So can you kind of come back to what's the solution to overfitting, let's say, in this context of if you have a company that's providing rewards to their employees for things, or you have a healthcare situation, what's the solution to when society's overfitting problems?
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, the like in the broadest strokes, the solution to overfitting is what's called regularization, which means that you want to penalize a model based on the complexity of the model. So you want to introduce a trade-off where you need to factor in not only how well does this model optimize the function that I'm trying to optimize, but is the complexity of that model justified? And so I think this is one of these things where, you know, living in an increasingly, like, you know, machine learning driven world, et cetera, has created a situation in which, like, our ability to optimize various things, you know, is reaching levels of complexity that are, you know, enormous. And I think that is precisely the situation in which it introduces those problems.
Yeah, I think it's ultimately a two-part solution. So regularization is like the mechanism, and then you have to decide how much to regularize, right? So this comes down to what I was saying, this gap between what you can measure and what matters. But sometimes you don't know what that gap is, right? If you're trying to make predictions about the future, or you only have data from the past, how can you know how different the data you have from the past are going to be relative to the data from the future? So the other part of that solution is using methods that allow you to kind of estimate how bad a generalization you're going to make. And so the kinds of techniques that are used for doing this are methods that are called cross-validation. So what cross-validation is basically like pretending that some of the data that you observed, you never got to see, right? So, you know, one way that you can simulate the future is to say, well, if I have data from the last 10 years of the stock market, maybe what I should be doing is pretending I have data from the last 9 years of the stock market and then seeing how well I can predict, you know, that remaining 1 year that I've got. And then you can do that for, you know, pull out different years and so on. And then you can figure out how much you should be regularizing, right? How much simpler you should be making your model based on how well it's doing in predicting the data that you're holding out.
Now, what about for, let's say, human beings that are kind of setting these scenarios up? Is there advice to them? So let's say I'm a manager of a team, or maybe I'm, you know, there's a CEO running a healthcare company, and I'm creating incentives for my team, right? And so obviously the team is going to begin to try to do things that achieve those incentives. And let's say I have a feeling that it's driving bad behavior, right? That the incentives are not aligned. What's the equivalent of a regularization decision, if you will, for a human being as they set up the problem? Or how do you change the incentives from that kind of concept in a practical way without a mathematical formulation behind it?
I mean, one of the things that we talk about in the book is what's called early stopping, which is where you literally cut off the process of optimizing something in time. And so, you know, if you have the hunch that your employees are, for example, figuring out really crafty ways to hit all of these marks without doing the thing that you were hoping to inspire them to do, one of the ways, I think, to deal with that is just, you know, maintain a moving target, because it will take them time to figure out all of the hacks and loopholes. If you're constantly shifting what exactly the structure of the goal is, then it prevents that process from taking root. Yeah,
right. That's interesting. Yeah, to shift it around. What can governments or policymakers? How can they use? Coming back to another point, but I guess the question was kind of how can governments use algorithms in decision making? Obviously, and I think to some degree, maybe you could kind of expand on, you know, assumptions go into some really big decisions, you know, whether that be potentially even going to war, right? If Iraq has weapons of mass destruction, then we should do something. And those assumptions don't always turn out, let's say, to be true. So how do governments make decisions in what you might call incomplete information, or how do these assumptions like all tie together?
Well, so I think there are two interesting applications here. So one is just that, you know, governments face the same kinds of decisions that we face at a larger scale, and to the extent that that's true, these same kinds of ideas about, you know, optimal stopping, explore, exploit, and so on are relevant. Although you can make the argument that, for example, you know, the explore-exploit problem that a government faces is very different from the one that a human being faces, because human beings intrinsically live a certain amount of time, and a government might be thinking on a very different kind of time scale.
That's interesting,
right?
Yep.
So I think, you know, this is actually one of the insights that you get out of thinking about these algorithms about what makes us human from this kind of computational perspective, right? So if you had an AI that, you know, was able to do all of these kinds of things and make optimal decisions, what's going to be characteristically different about the way that human beings make decisions? And one of those characteristic differences is that we human beings are, you know, finite in time in a way that, you know, an AI system wouldn't necessarily be, and in a way that a government isn't necessarily as well. So I think thinking about how those things change when you change the scale is very interesting. Brian mentioned the explore-exploit trade-off and clinical trials. That's an example of a case where the government really does have to make a decision about, you know, what are the best treatments for people and what should be approved and so on, and they're using exactly the same kind of calculus of explore-exploit. But the other class of problems where I think taking this perspective is useful is that in many ways the government is engaged in posing computational problems to we, the people, right? That the government constructs the problems that we have to solve. And so taking this perspective where we think about the difficulty of problems from a computational kind of, you know, using a computational lens is something that reveals that certain problems are relatively easy and certain problems, you know, are incredibly hard. So this comes up, for example, in scheduling. So if you tell people that you want them to minimize the maximum amount by which any of the jobs that you give them is late, the maximum amount by which it exceeds its deadline, right? Then there's a simple optimal strategy that they can follow in order to do that. They should just work through the jobs in order of their deadline. But if you tell them to do that, and that some of the jobs are more important than others, and what you really care about is minimizing the maximum amount that something is late multiplied by its importance, suddenly you have a problem which doesn't have a simple solution and in fact falls into this class of intractable problems. So knowing that, if you're the government and you're sort of giving people their incentive structures and telling them what they should be doing, then you should try and avoid giving them problems of that second kind because they're going to be really hard for them to solve. There's no simple strategy for them to follow. And so we talk about this in the book in terms of what we call computational kindness, that you can be kind to others in terms of the problems that you pose them when thought about in terms of the computational costs that you're incurring.
That's interesting, yeah.
There's an example that I think is another good illustration of this point, which is in the chapter on game theory, we talk about auction design. And a lot of things in life, if you think about it, are structured in the form of auctions, buying a house being an example. So buying a house is what's called a first price auction. So you have a bunch of bidders, they write down a price. The person who writes down the highest price gets the house and they pay the price that they wrote down. So far, so good, except there's this complicated problem, which is if you write down the absolute highest price that you would be willing to pay, then, you know, in this sort of pedantic sense, you get no utility if you pay exactly what you think it's worth. And so in reality, what everyone does is you have to what's called shade your bid. You have to anticipate the bids of the other people because ideally you still want to win, but you want to win at the lowest possible price. And so it requires getting into the head of the other bidders. What do I think they think I think they think? How many other people are in the auction? Are they going to be aggressive? Or should I be too aggressive? You know, whatever. There's this really lovely principle that we talk about in game theory that's called the revelation principle. And the idea is that it sounds kind of too good to be true, but this is a real result, which is that every auction can be replaced with an auction that has different rules. It will give the same good to the same person for the same price, but require no strategy on the part of the participants. And so the auction mechanism in this case is what's called a second price auction, which is everyone bids on the house, the person with the highest bid wins, but they only have to pay the amount of the second highest bidder. It turns out that the Nash equilibrium in this game, the best you can possibly do is to just write down exactly what you think the good is worth. And so this is one of these examples where, added to all of the frustrations of Bay Area real estate is the fact that, like, real estate in general uses an auction format which is needlessly computationally demanding of the people that participate in it. So I think there's a lot of opportunity. And the government has used some of these ideas. In the book, we talked to Paul Milgram, who helped the FCC kind of redesign their wireless spectrum auctions so that they would have some of these computational benefits. And I think there's a lot more that we can do to take that same idea and that same methodology and make it something that affects the rest of us in our lives.
So there's I'm going to use this one and then ask a more broad question after this, but there's a few questions about, some of the big decisions might be easy, but how do you make small decisions? How do you use algorithms to make these little small decisions in life? And I think you've touched on some, but, you know, how do I choose provolone or Swiss? Should I dump Windows 10 and go to Mac? Or, you know, what are involved in making those types of decisions? I mean, are those algorithmic decisions, or is that something that, well, let me frame that in maybe the broader, the bigger question, which is, you use a quote from Jeff Bezos about why he started Amazon, which he in essence said, you know, quitting his job and starting his Amazon was a simple decision. I mean, this is a big decision in life, but even if he failed that, he wouldn't regret it when he was 80, right? And I think you touched on regret. And then you also bring up this idea of, which I really liked, and maybe it relates to this, so you can kind of tie it into the context of carpe diem, which is seizing the day versus, you know, paraphrasing, you know, seizing your life, these two different timescales. So how are algorithms relevant for us in the decisions that we make in our life? And how do we, what information should we use to make those decisions?
So for the first part of the question, thinking about these problems in terms of algorithms, you recognize that there's a trade-off between, you know, the how good the solution is and how much time you spend thinking about it, right? So if the outcomes aren't that different, you shouldn't spend any time thinking about it. So you could just flip a coin if you're trying to choose what kind of cheese to have. And in fact, flipping a coin might be a good strategy because it does exploration for you and, you know, gives you some information.
You get out of your own subjective bias decision.
So I think you know, the one thing that comes out of the explore-exploit trade-off is that you don't have to feel like you have to make the optimal decision every time, because even if you don't choose the very best thing, you got some information which you might be able to use in the future. So I think that's a way of forgiving yourself for not necessarily trying to over-optimize each of those individual decisions.
Interesting. And I guess... Well, I guess we're getting close to the end of the program, so we've reached the point where I think there's only time for maybe one last question and wrap up. And kind of what I'd like to ask you about is, and maybe you started to touch on it, but maybe you could touch on more, is as you've looked at all of algorithms and how they apply to lives, what's the take home point that people should take away to say, if I don't know how to apply them or apply them, or given that you have looked at them all, what should I take away from algorithms as a point?
I think kind of continuing from what Tom was just saying, you know, that in some ways, thinking about the problems that we face in our own lives computationally gives us a different standard. I think if we don't get the outcome that we want in a particular decision, we often call into question the process by which we made that decision. And there are many domains that we talk about in the book in which the problem is just a hard problem. So the 37, you know, if you read the fine print on the 37% rule, it only works 37% of the time. it just happens that optimal stopping is a hard problem. And so even when you follow the best possible strategy, you still fail 63% of the time. It just so happens there's no way to do any better than that. And so this is one of the things that we talk about at the conclusion of the book is, that we can turn, in a way, to computer science for a kind of, you know, computational stoicism, that knowing that you are following a process that is the best process or that has some kind of guarantee gives you consolation even in those moments where you don't get the result that you want.
I think that's a beautiful point to live by. It gives us compassion for ourselves, for our own failures, and when we don't make the right decision, right? It's not our fault. It's just the algorithm's fault. Okay, I think that's wonderful. So it's not our fault, it's the algorithm's fault. So our thanks to Brian Christian and Tom Griffiths, authors of Algorithms to Live By, The Computer Science of Human Decisions. I'm Soren Solari, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know, is adjourned. Thank you.